In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Glad you're joining us here on the iSpy Radio Show, where every week we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. And of course, there are no bigger examples of big government than the left's environmental movement and socialists, both of which can't exist without big government, because they need big government to enforce laws in favor of the environment over the interests of mankind, and socialists need big government to take away God-given rights of individuals in favor of the collective good of the state. You know, some years ago, I was attending a Marion County breakfast meeting where a Republican candidate for governor was speaking, and things were going quite well right up until the last question, when someone asked him about the environmentalists stopping a new runway at the Portland airport through one of their infamous environmental lawsuits. And the candidate said, you know, we just have to face the fact that environmentalists run this state, and that's never going to change. Wow. Well, it won't change if that's your approach. Things are changing because people of courage are willing to take a stand. And there's some good news today. The Trump administration recently announced changes to the Endangered Species Act that could actually save species instead of just saving jobs and money for the environmental Nazis. In the second half of our show, well, there is a brief bit on the dark side. Here's a hint. Guns don't kill people, but socialists do. Bernie goes full-blown Nazi. But the main focus of today is good news, including some good news out of Hollywood for a change. Are we in for a major positive cultural shift? We'll talk about that with James Herson. I'd like to welcome Dr. Bob Zybak to the show. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science with a focus on wildfires. He is our longtime consultant for issues of forestry and timber industry and logging and on all things impacting the environment, especially with his hands-on experience. Dr. Bob, it's great to talk to you.
Good talking to you with you again, Mark.
Yeah, you know, we wanted to have you on to talk about some good news for a change about the ESA, that's the Endangered Species Act. But before we get there, let's get some potentially bad news out of the way, because at least I suspect that's what you have to say, or that it's likely going to be bad news. And that's the Elliott Forest. Where does all of that lie?
Well, the concern with the Elliott Forest remains the same. And I guess if it's bad news, it's been going on for a while.
Yes.
The main problem is that it's the common school fund land, Oregon's first forest, and with what they've been trying to do, sell it, and that has caused a lot of economic damage to our schools and to the forest as well. So the concern there is ongoing, that the land was greatly undervalued. They've been trying to sell it. They've been mismanaging it. They've been losing money, and it's 80,000 acres of prime timberland that belongs to the Common School Fund, and the people that are not suffering, but the people that are being shortchanged or ripped off by this process are Oregon's school children.
Just to remind our audience, or maybe new members who haven't heard this before, the Oregon Common School Fund, this is a timberland that's set up so that it can be harvested and sold, and the proceeds from which go into the school fund. Last we knew, you were part of a team trying to get the powers that be to adopt the Gezi plan. Remind our audience about that plan and why it would actually work for what everyone's trying to do, and where are things now with that effort?
Okay. Well, first I'd like to say that Wayne Gezi passed on this summer.
Yes.
And he pushed the Gezi plan for 30 or 40 years, and we saw the Elliott as an ideal place to experiment. So he talked with the governor personally, and we've met with the dean of forestry and the president of Oregon State, and to promote it. The Elliott has the opportunity to produce about $20 or $25 million a year for our schools, and just as importantly, about 400 or 450 jobs for Douglas and Coos County. So the Gezi plan was 20 years in extent. It had an ending point, and the idea was to replicate Oregon State's paired watershed study, but do it on the Elliott and really compare the differences in wildlife population responses to one, clear cuts, which has been going on for as long as we've had wildfires and volcanic eruptions, and two older forest stands, to see where the animals bed, how they were affected population-wise and so on. Those are the important research questions that still need to be answered regarding endangered species and our Douglas fir forests. And the Elliott offers an ideal opportunity to do that type of research. And so that's what the Giese plan proposed. Jobs, income, and pay Oregon State to do the research rather than make Oregon State pay to do it.
Hmm. And as I understand it, some of the plans that were on the table, the Giese plan was pretty much going to be the only one that allowed harvesting or that would profit. Am I remembering that right?
It's the only one that looks like it. They're waiting for an HCP, which is a Habitat Conservation Plan. And because it's an acronym, you know, it's a government program. And they want to see how much is going to be set aside for marbled murrelets, coho. I think those are the main ones, spotted owls as well, before they agree to pay $110 million to get title to the property in order to manage it for research purposes. But I think the problem is they're looking at it from a perspective, say, of Portland or Salem, where they think they can sell carbon credits and make money that way, that they divorce themselves essentially from the school with the cash payoff that the students have to pay back.
And reality. They do a good job of divorcing themselves from reality as well.
Well, you and I might say that, but I think the idea is that they think that we all want to learn about global warming, and that's the best use for the Elliott, and that they can sell carbon credits and provide the endangered species habitat, and it's all theoretical, and none of it is common sense or practical, and there's no way that that's going to work. But they've been pushing it through the channels, and that's why one reason we're losing money there.
Losing money, yes, absolutely. And this notion that you can cut down a tree, and for some reason they don't think that it'll grow back. Go figure. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back, we'll be talking about the Endangered Species Act, especially Bob's personal experiences with this. And in fact, we'll be talking about the other spotted owl. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, talking about the Endangered Species Act today on the iSpy Radio Show. And we're doing that with Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science. His academic focus was on wildfires. He is our longtime consultant for issues of forestry and timber and environmental issues as well. So before we get to your own personal experiences with what I call the other spotted owl, just kind of give us an overview of the Endangered Species Act, because this is something that as far as I'm concerned, has really been used as really a weapon, I think, in the environmentalist movement. It's been used to take away land from ranchers or shut access down to land. It certainly had a major impact here in Oregon on logging. A perfect example, of course, is the spotted owl that was used as the basis for severely curtailing logging and ushering in an era of huge environmental laws and regulations that nearly choked the timber industry to death. So would you say that I have encapsulated the Endangered Species Act fairly well there, or am I missing something?
Well, no, I think you've encapsulated the downside of the Endangered Species Act for sure. It's really been debilitating, and not just for loggers, for sawmill workers, for tree planters, for road builders, and for all of the motels and restaurants and gas stations that depend on income from working people. So it's been very debilitating for the rural populations. There's been impact into the urban populations, but they've been largely invisible to urban people. Their newspapers get smaller, their houses cost more, so it's an incremental minor discomfort. But in the rural areas, it's caused billions of dollars worth of damage. It's put tens of thousands of people out of work. It's caused degradation of the infrastructure in those areas. And I think that there's a causal relationship between critical habitat and massive wildfires we've been having the last 15 and 20 years. So the economic consequences haven't really been looked at or analyzed or really admitted almost with what goes along with it.
Well, I certainly
the
think
cost.
I certainly think that, well, for one, just to respond to what you said earlier, is that I do think that there has been some beneficial aspects to the Endangered Species Act. Certainly we have it has raised awareness of some of these endangered species. But as far as the economic impact, I think that's the thing that really gets overlooked by so many of these governmental bureaucracies, is because it's almost like it has led, the Endangered Species Act has really led into this notion of hands off the environment. You can't somehow have mankind and these endangered species living together, and I think that's it has led to disastrous policies for the forest. And it's this notion of, well, we just can't touch any of it. Mankind can't be anywhere near it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's right. It teaches us or demonstrates that they think that the man's a pathogen that doesn't have a place in nature, that's adversarial to other animals. My degree is in historical ecology. I studied the relationship of people within the environment. What impact do we have by using fire constantly, by being efficient hunters and efficient fishermen, and being able to practice agriculture? How does that affect other animal populations? Mm-hmm. And what are the effects even aesthetically on the environment? So the Endangered Species Act says that humans are unwanted, that we need these areas set aside without human impact, and that creates a unique circumstance. Those areas didn't exist without human impact in the past, and the animals adapted to humans.
Yes.
So why are we now creating a an artificial situation in which human activity is seen as a negative?
Yeah. Well, you know, whenever I think of the spotted owl, I remember my MBA accounting professor testifying to the Oregon legislature during the early days of spotted owl, and he said they didn't need, they meaning the spotted owls, not the legislature, they didn't need old growth forests. They would nest anywhere. They had a nesting pair, actually, in the rafters of their logging company sawmill, so go figure. I do want to talk, though, about your personal experiences with this, because the other spotted owl, as I said, the marbled murrelet, you have a great article that you wrote for Oregon Fish and Wildlife Journal, that we'll put up on our website. So talk to us a bit about that bird and just give us some of the general characteristics of it.
Well, one of the interesting characteristics is that Chuck Meslow's grad student has made a living studying the marbled murrelet, just as Chuck Meslow's grad student, another one, made a living studying spotted owls. They both worked in concert with a small handful of other Oregon State University professors and ex-professors, Jerry Franklin in particular, to somehow say that these animals are dependent on forests, for one, and that their main endangerment was logging. So that the logging had to be regulated, it had to be stopped in order to protect these birds. So the spotted owl with the Clinton Forest Plan in the early 90s created a bunch of artificial circles, like crop circles, almost literally, in the environment, in which they said logging could not take place. And then that caused some very serious downturns economically, but it also left open, I think they called them matrix lands, places that weren't covered by these circles. So the marbled murrelet stepped in and said, well, it needs all of the Douglas fir within 50 or 60 miles of the coast.
Crazy.
So that filled in the missing parts.
Well, and it also led to some policies that you mentioned here in your article. Talk to us how that unfolded with Kim Nelson there.
Nelson was a graduate student of Meslow, And in the late 80s, I corresponded with her. She was wondering what the history of the Coast Range was. And so I pointed out that my PhD studies, in fact, had to do with the wildfire history of the Coast Range, in which essentially 60 or 80% of it was clear cut, with massive forest fires, mostly between 1849 and then the Tillamook fires of 1933, 39, and 45, and 51. So that 100-year period, most of the Coast Range burnt. Most of the trees were killed. So if the animals were dependent on forests, especially a seabird like the murrelet that lives in the ocean and eats fish, if they were dependent on forests, then we should have seen some kind of response population-wise to these fires, or to the Columbus Day storm, or the Mount St. Helens eruption. They should have had immediate consequences on these animals, and we should be able to measure them. However, what they said was clear-cut logging, starting in 1850, killed off 60 to 80% of these birds. The whole thing is a fabrication.
Yeah.
When it happened, I protested. That was the early 90s. And it's like, no, they've never logged that much. There's never been any causal relationship shown between logging and murrelet population numbers. The birds fly 60 to 90 miles an hour up and down the coast. They're not limited to Western Oregon by any stretch. So the whole thing was just fabricated. And then this past year, after my article came out, Portland Audubon Society put out a big article. They interviewed people, including Kim Nelson at Oregon State, and they said 60 to 80% of the birds had been killed by logging. So not true.
Well, it's absurd to the point of just...
It's absurd.
I don't even really have a good word for it other than absurd, but I mean, when you look at what you presented in terms of the science, she took that and did the exact opposite, and then we used some weird fuzzy math to come up with her conclusions on that, all of which led to adding to the issues with the spotted owl and shutting down logging even further. We do have some good news, though. There have been some changes from the Trump administration on the Endangered Species Act. We'll talk about that next with Dr. Bob Zybak. And welcome back. We're talking about the Endangered Species Act. We're doing that with Dr. Bob Zybak. He has a PhD from Oregon State University in environmental sciences, and we'd like to have him on whenever we need some good insights on what is going on in the environmental world. So, Dr. Bob, there has been some good news with the Endangered Species Act. Can you give us sort of an overview of what some of these policy changes have been?
Yeah, I think the Endangered Species Act was well-intentioned, and the original intent of the people that framed it was good. It's been overtaken by lawyers and environmentalists and misused, and I think mostly through the establishment of so-called critical habitat, which is basically a handful of bureaucrats playing with computers and coming up with some ideas, because it doesn't conform to what the animals require. So the changes that are really good, one is that they list the bird as endangered or threatened, and the endangered one is where they go all out and start shutting down forests and industries and massive amounts of land and that. And threatened is just that keep an eye on them. But Fish and Wildlife Service has been treating them both as the same. So if a animal lists as threatened, it's the same treatment as if it were endangered, and then there's massive costs associated with that. So another part of the plan is to look at an economic analysis. The spotted owl was called a billion-dollar bird 30 years ago. The marbled murrelet has streaked past it. It's caused hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage to our common school fund and our schools alone. And billions of dollars when you figure out infrastructures and businesses and rural families and rural communities over time. And that's never been even acknowledged, much less analyzed. So this gives us better information to make better decisions and a better chance to focus on the species that we have actually endangered and can do something about.
Hmm. And reading some of the responses to what's going on is that the left, of course, is out there bemoaning that now suddenly we're going to be out there murdering bald eagles in the thousands. It's just utter nonsense. But they keep pushing this notion of economics is now going to be part of this. I mean, that's one of the common threads that I saw, is that they are just absolutely appalled that economic factors would even be considered. And they actually, in fact, one of them, NPR, actually had to issue a correction. They said this: a previous version of this story said that economic costs would be taken into account when determining whether a species warrants protection. In fact, while an economic analysis will be allowed, that analysis will not be part of the listing decision. So, again, I think the left just hyperventilates whenever you start trying to rein in a clearly out-of-control policy.
I think that's true. I think there's a lot of public favor towards wilderness areas and towards the Endangered Species Act, and a lot of that has to do with the media promoting it. And a lot of those really strong supporters live in urban environments, and they don't see the actual biological and economic and aesthetic consequences to their actions. So by getting economic information into the mix, then people are able to make much better decisions and to see exactly what these things are costing. It doesn't make a difference as to whether it's listed or not, but it does make a difference as to people's understanding of what's involved in attempting to maintain selected species.
Well, one of the other things, too, that I found to be very interesting is that some of the left-leaning analysis of this, too, was that they admit that, okay, there has been some issues with the ESA in the past, and they admit that, oh, yes, it really is the most powerful piece of environmental legislation in the U.S., and they do think that it could be more effective, but weakening it will not make it more effective. That's what they're claiming anyway, that these rule changes are weakening things. But I think
it's strengthening.
Absolutely, I do, because it's now incentivizing landowners to be involved in this, and I think it really will start fixing some of these problems. But would you care to hazard a guess as to what they think would make the ESA more effective?
You know, I think the whole thing is that it's a group of people that don't like logging. There's a whole environmental law industry, and I think that most everybody has no idea how the Endangered Species Act operates and how to measure its effectiveness. If we measure it in recovered species, it hasn't been very effective at all. They've taken credit for species that were fine, but the law has been onerous. It's been incredibly expensive. It hasn't been particularly effective. And to involve the rural populations in the management of these animals is a big step forward, and I think that's the improvement that's being made as they're fine-tuning the law.
Bob, you have far too much common sense, because they narrowed it down to one thing. Leah Gerber with Arizona State University says that they could make the act more effective if they had more funding.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's what it is.
It's
money.
Political.
It's money. You know,
yep.
You mentioned that that the rural communities have been hit to the tune of billions of dollars. You know, maybe we ought to look at putting rural communities on the list of endangered species. And Dr. Bob, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today, and we'll make sure that we'll put up your article there on with your own experiences with the other spotted owl. We'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark. I've enjoyed it.
We will have a press release from Pacific Legal Foundation about improvements to the ESA on our website. Just look for today's show page. Here are a couple of key takeaways, though. One, the Endangered Species Act has proven effective at preventing extinctions, but not at promoting species recovery. Well, that's kind of odd. You would think that the point of the law would be to promote species recovery of these endangered animals. Two, previously, the ESA undermined property rights and denied property owners any reward for helping that recovery. The new rule aligns the incentives of landowners with the interests of species. And what a dramatic change that is. Up until now, environmentalists had been incentivized to keep species endangered, bring lawsuits, recoup inflated legal fees and judgments. It was nothing but a moneymaker for them. Now landowners will be actually incentivized to help species recover. Good news for landowners and good news for species. As I said, that will be up on iSpyRadioShow.com. Just look for today's show page for that press release. Coming up next, James Herson, some other good news and out of some surprising places. He's a pundit for Newsmax.com and author of the popular weekly column, The Left Coast Report, where he takes a humorous poke at the politics of Hollywood. And other of his great articles can be found at jamesherson.com. And, of course, we're talking to James Herson himself. James, it's great to talk to you.
Hey, great to be with you and talk to you.
Yeah, you know, the focus of our show is to give a little bit more uplifting stories this week. You've got two really good ones and one that's maybe not quite so uplifting, but I think it needs to be talked about. But you've got a really interesting article up there now about Kanye West. And this is a guy who has certainly seen ups and downs. He's very popular right now, thanks to the reality show that his wife stars on, the Kardashians. And you have an article up there at jamesherson.com, Kanye West's music gets born again. And this really gets into his Christian beliefs in life. Can you take us through what you found out about Kanye?
Sure. Well, first of all, we know that Kanye West, he's known for sort of going against the grain, of course. Mm-hmm. And, he was seen hugging the president of the United States wearing a MAGA hat, which infuriated people and started castigating him on the social media. But Kanye has recently, I guess, he's had, I would call it flirtations with Christianity. It's been reflected in some of his lyrics over the years. And much like so many in African-American, in the African-American community, they're exposed to Christianity in a very strong Christian church in the African-American community. I'm one of, I was privileged when I used to make a living as a musician. I filled in for some musicians and played in a very authentic African-American church. I'm familiar with that tradition. And so Kanye has that tradition. And of course, he's married to Kim Kardashian, whose dad, Robert Kardashian, was an Armenian Orthodox Christian. And so they've been exposed to Christianity, but something has happened to that family. And recently on a show that's up on Apple, Nicki Minaj, who is not known for Christianity and not known for wholesomeness. She's a female rapper, but she's a colleague of Kanye, was on a show. They were discussing religion. And she says, Kanye told me that he's born again, that he's a born again Christian. And Kanye himself put out a tweet which said that. So you add all of those things to something that Kim Kardashian did, where she used her Instagram account to put up a photo that really was letting it be known that Kanye West was going to come out with a new album, or as they say, drop a new album. That's what they say on social media.
Yeah.
And so the photo shows a title and a list of songs, 12 songs, the title of the album, and it's written like kind of on a scratch pad, but you can tell this was a promo. It's a professional picture. And the title says, Jesus is King. And the songs, the 12 songs, are Christian-themed titles of songs, very obvious things like Sunday Baptized, God is, Sweet Jesus. And then there's a little notebook where lyrics are scratched in, and they're all Christian-themed. And then it's on the bottom, it said a date, which is still to come, September 27th, that's when the album's going to drop. And you then add another factor, is that beginning this year, Kanye started holding these gatherings on Sundays. He called them Sunday services. And in the beginning, they were really friends, and there were some celebrities, and they got together and they prayed and they listened to Christian themed music and they had discussions. And then they started bringing in guest pastors, like the guest pastor who conducted the wedding ceremony for Kim and Kanye. And increasingly, the Sunday services look like a church service.
Mm.
And you put all that together, and then I think is what is happening is that Kanye West has decided to basically be a Christian artist. And this is at a time when there's a guy who's respected in the hip hop community. His name is Lecrae. And he is a guy who is a rapper that began as a Christian artist, has been extremely successful. And in the term that's used in the music industry, Lecrae crossed over, which means that some of his songs were acceptable on the secular hip hop stations. And then also at a time where there's another rapper named called Chance the Rapper. And a lot of your listeners haven't heard of these things, so they have to consult their kids. But Chance the Rapper's out of Chicago. He is also, I would say, a way to describe it is coming out as Christian. So there seems to be a kind of a revival in the hip hop world.
Yeah.
Kind of an amazing move of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Yeah, and you kind of have to wonder what's behind all that. You know, he was meeting Trump in the White House, and you know, Trump is constantly surrounded by a lot of these pastors. Some of them are from, you know, they're black pastors and have very dynamic churches. And you kind of wonder if there was some connection there that when Kanye was visiting the White House, maybe he met some of these guys. So it's really fascinating to see this transformation. You know, on your article, you do say this, words and phrases which appear to be lyric ideas written on a notepad with the phrase, "He will defend," are seen immediately above the words kingdom, lion, and fire. You know, if he wants to go, for somebody that wants to go against the grain all the time, maybe it's a song about Trump.
You know, it's possible. But I think it's a song about God.
I think so too.
There's another thing to add to it. Kim Kardashian did a recent interview with Forbes magazine, and she talked about their family reading the Bible and praying. And it's just, and you know, I personally pray that this is not like a Bob Dylan thing where it just lasts a little while.
Stunt. Yeah.
And the reason I say it would be a blessing is because, you know, this, when you put this couple together, Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, this has nothing to do with whether you're a fan or you like them or anything else. They are possibly the most influential two people combined in the pop culture, because of the fact that you're talking about this reality show that has a lot of unfortunate aspects and has defined sort of the reality culture. And then you're talking about probably the preeminent rapper. And so those two together could have an enormous,
profound
influence, which is why when Kanye West, decided to go public and say and hug Donald Trump, and he was going to, you know, he was a Trump supporter. He had a picture taken with a MAGA hat. There was hysterics over
there. Oh, sure there were. But you know, there was
a political aspect to it. And the left hates. Look, I know there's some people who claim to be Christians and they claim to be left of center, but the fact is, the left hates.
Yes.
Biblical Christianity.
Yeah, yes,
and they hate
they
anyone involved with who loves Christ and believes in the Bible and wants to follow traditional teachings. They hate them because it's a threat.
Yes.
Because it's a threat to an agenda that now has revealed itself.
It absolutely is a threat to that agenda. And in fact, I want to talk to you about that agenda in the next segment. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with James Herson. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking to James Herson. He is a New York Times bestselling author, international business attorney, news analyst, and commentator. You can catch a lot of his great articles up there on jamesherson.com. We're talking about some of those today. And, you know, you were talking about how the left really hates biblical Christianity because it is a direct threat to them. And I think that's absolutely right. But I'd just like to revisit the Kardashians just for a moment, because that, I think, is one of the things that people on the left don't understand about Trump and especially about evangelicals. Because you look at the lives that the Kardashians have led, you look at the lives that Kanye himself have led, not exactly upstanding Christians, but what Christians, especially evangelicals, love is somebody that repents and turns away from that lifestyle. And that, I think, is why evangelicals have embraced Trump so much, is because, yeah, he was a party guy. He's done some things that he admits are not the best thing, but he's really embracing God now, and that's why I think he resonates so much with evangelicals.
Absolutely, and, you know, unfortunately, it gets lost in the media distortion about evangelicals, about really all stripes of Christians who take Christianity seriously, is that Christianity is not at all about exclusion. It's about inclusion, because Christianity teaches that we are classified the same way. All of us are sinners in need of repentance, in need of God's mercy. And that puts us all in the same boat. And that excludes no one. It's just that, unfortunately, particularly in the mainstream media, parts of the Democrat Party and Hollywood, there are people who are so invested in a licentious lifestyle, they feel threatened and judged by anyone who will put forth principles that make them feel a slight bit of guilt or shame. Yeah. And they lash out with this incredible, visceral hatred that really it's biblical in and of itself, because they feel so threatened. But that's why we have to pray for Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, because they're going to feel that bigger backlash than what they just felt with embracing Donald Trump.
Yes.
You know, you embraced publicly in the pop culture, you embraced Christ, and, you know, you're going to experience tribulation, and that's what they are going to experience.
They could maybe pass off the fact that he's embracing Trump to some sort of mental illness, but this is a spiritual change, and boy, that will not go over well. You have another great article up there on jamesherson.com, and it's a little bit darker, so I'd like to get this out of the way, but it's important. The article is called "Bernie Sanders Turns into Bernie Sanger," and you write about Bernie's push for population control over the made-up concern of climate change. As climate change or global warming's fake science is really starting to take hold, Bernie is prepared to sacrifice lives to save us from death. I mean, this is no different in my mind than Mayan sacrifices to the sun god, because this notion of climate change has just become an absolute religion. So how does he plan on lowering population?
Well, you know, what this came from, Mark, is that excruciatingly horrible 7-hour climate change town hall they had.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I think they should save that tape and use it for in the event that they have to interrogate terrorists. I think it will work better than waterboarding. They show them that, because it really was unwatchable. It was horrid.
It was.
But anyway, and that, so Bernie Sanders gets asked a question where the presentation says, you know, we have this terrible problem of human population growth, as has been talked about since the 50s and the 60s, and that this is part of the fight against climate change. What are you going to do about that? Would you be courageous enough to make human population growth a part of your battle against climate change? To which Sanders says, you know, of course I would. You know, he jumps on this, and he brings up the Mexico City policy, which was the one that Ronald Reagan put into effect, which basically said that our tax money couldn't be used for programs and NGOs, non-governmental organizations across the world to encourage women to have abortions and to basically terminate the lives of unborn human beings. And Sanders, oh, we're going to reverse that Mexico City agreement. And, you know, we're going to allow more women to have abortions. And one of the things he brought up was people in poor countries, people in poverty, where women don't necessarily want to have large numbers of babies. So then we should make, you know, this birth control, which, by the way, he equated birth control with abortion, which is very revealing.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what Planned Parenthood
does.
And that's exactly what the abortion advocates do.
Yes. It seems like once again, the left really reveals itself when you just let them talk, you know, whether it's gun control or in this case, lowering populations. I really wish that people would take this seriously. When you give someone political power, you are giving them legal authority over your life. Socialism is not some nice old guy who wants to give away free stuff. This is deadly serious. And I really do wish that people would take somebody like Bernie seriously. I know he's kind of comes across as a buffoon sometimes, but they're serious. They want to get rid of billions of people.
Absolutely. Look, the whole notion of socialism is based on the concept of central planning, which is an Orwellian term. Central planning means lack of freedom, that government does the planning, government meaning autocrats, meaning dictators. Central planning involves coercion.
Yes.
So if you have coercion involved in population, you're going to have what we saw in China. You're going to have people forced to not be able to procreate or to take the lives of children, which is exactly what was happening in China.
Sure.
And
of course,
we
see this with the Virginia governor, too, infanticide is perfectly fine. We should just be doing that. It really is shocking. Fortunately, we have some good news coming up. We'll be talking about a new Christian movie coming out. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now here on the I Spy Radio Show, talking today to James Herson. He's a New York Times bestselling author. And you can find all of his articles up at jamesherson.com. We'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. So there is some good news out there. Why don't you tell us about this new movie that's just come out, Overcomer?
Sure. This is called Overcomer, and it's put out by Alex and Stephen Kendrick, who have put out a lot of faith-based movies. They've done amazing things. And the little little talked about secret in Hollywood is when they talk about the margin, the percentage of profit, there are two genres that are the most popular in Hollywood. They're kind of flip sides of a coin. One is horror and the other are faith-based movies. And the reason for the profit margin being large is in both cases, they cost less to produce because they're not as dependent on major stars and not as dependent on expensive effects. And secondly, there's a very huge market for them. Now, the faith-based market is the majority of the country, and the majority of people are generally upset with the kind of content, especially if they're families, that Hollywood puts out. They're upset with the gratuitous sex, the over violent and dark plots that Hollywood, especially at this time of year in the autumn, because they're seeking awards. So here comes a movie, Overcomer. And it's like its name, its first weekend out, it did better than expected.
Yes.
And for a film that cost $5 million, it did well over $8 million and is going strong. And this is a movie that has this thing that's been missing from a lot of Hollywood content. What's it called? A story with character.
No. Movies are just, CGI, computer graphic stuff, people flying here and there and shooting, and always ends in a giant battle at the end. So, yeah, that's what a movie is.
And people are lifted up by the movie. Yes. They come out of the theaters. They're actually, they have tears in their eyes. Not the kind of tears that are not tears because you're sad. And they're not really so just tears because you're happy. It's because you see something that reaches into your soul and you connect with it. And it really, you're getting a glimpse of the character of God. When it always causes people, it causes people when they see a real sentimental commercial, they'll start tearing up. And the Kendrick brothers really know how to write these movies and do it. It's a refreshing change. And yet we got to give these people credit, because every single one of these faith-based movies is an uphill battle in every way. Because there's a bias against them. They have a hard time getting the kind of financing that secular movies are able to get. The studios reluctantly set up an orphan division for this, and they make it very difficult. That's why so many of the big faith-based movies had to be financed outside of the Hollywood industry.
And it's shocking, really, because so many of these do really quite well. I mean, look at the success that Hallmark Movie Channel has had. I mean, they have just been going absolutely gangbusters. James, unfortunately, we're up against the clock.
Yeah,
so
man,
we're gonna
have, huge.
Yes, it sure is, and growing, too, and that's great to see. James, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been awesome, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me. You have a blessed day.
You know, it's interesting how so much of what we conservatives predict about the left's slippery slope turns out to be true. Abortion won't lead to infanticide. Environmental laws won't lead to massive depopulation to get rid of people. Oh, gun laws don't mean we want to take away guns. That last one took all of a week to go from red flag gun confiscation laws to Beto O'Rourke saying, heck yes, you'll confiscate guns. Socialists mean it when they say they want to take over and transform America. Do you mean it when you say you want to defend America? I hope so, because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.